There is no prohibition of homosexuality in the Torah. With men, it's always about the act of penetration.
Women really have a harder time coming from a very Orthodox background. By the time they realize who they really are, they're pinned down with about 6 or 7 kids at home.
The film is provoking a lot of questions. The most important thing is the dialogue that results.
I said, sort of half jokingly, we should just make a record. And everyone laughed and fell into hysterics about how silly the idea was.
Lavender blues, just come and see. It's the lavender world when your feelings run free.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Pedophobia fuels the UN's renewed rejection of ILGA. Queer Orthodox and Hasidic Jews could be trembling soon at a theater near you. And historic Aussie out music is back. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May 4th, 2002. An attempt to revive a bid for consultative status at the United Nations for ILGA, the International Lesbian and Gay Association, was voted down this week. ILGA was the first and only lesbian and gay organization ever to have official standing with the UN, but after just 1 year, lost it in 1994 due to claims that three of its roughly 300 member groups supported pedophilia. ILGA went on to oust those groups, add the entire UN Convention on the Rights of the Child to its organizational constitution, and adopt a resolution declaring that ILGA categorically does not in any way seek to promote or seek the legalization of pedophilia, and applied for reinstatement. In January, the Non-Governmental Organizations Committee of the UN's Economic and Social Council rejected that application. As the full council met this week to consider that committee's recommendations, several European nations sought to force the committee to reconsider ILGA's application, but their proposal was defeated by a vote of 29-17 with 7 abstentions. ILGA will now have to wait until 2005 to try again. Support for ILGA this week was led by France, the Netherlands, and Germany. Australia and the U.S. also voted for ILGA, while Spain was the only European nation that did not. The opposition reiterated concerns about pedophilia and harped on ILGA's refusal to submit its membership list, which ILGA believes could endanger its constituents. ILGA said the opposition was primarily led by Egypt, which for the last year has been notoriously arresting and torturing suspected gay men. Pakistan, Sudan, and India also stood out among opponents. ILGA further noted that 2/3 of the opposition votes came from the nations that criminalize private consensual homosexual acts. ILGA Co-Secretary General Kursad Karamanoglu declared that a fundamental human right has been sacrificed at the altars of Islam and Catholicism.
A statement by Pope John Paul II this week drew protest from the Italian civil rights group Arcigay. An apostolic letter seeking to increase participation in private confession said that it is clear that penitents living in an habitual state of serious sin and who do not intend to change their situation cannot validly receive absolution. While the Pope did not identify specific groups, the letter was widely understood to refer to sexually active gays and lesbians and to divorcees who remarry. Leading Vatican theologian Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger neither confirmed nor denied that inference, but he did clarify that absolution could not be given in some cases because, in his words, the fundamental condition for absolution is that the person must separate from the sin, have the desire for change. This week's letter was in contrast to the Pope's indication in a sermon last week that absolution is a possibility even for priests who sexually abuse minors. Arcigay President Sergio Lochudis responded with a statement that any isolated act, even violent or with a minor, can be absolved if it's accompanied by a declaration of penance. The choice of having loving, stable, responsible, and conscious relations with a person of the same sex falls instead under the implacable hatchet of papal condemnation.
Meanwhile, secular Italy is about to broadcast Europe's first commercial TV channel to specifically target gays and lesbians. Gay.tv, produced by a Milan company with venture capital from the Netherlands, will begin Italian language satellite transmissions available free to viewers across the continent on May 6th. Initial capital should keep Gay.tv on the air for 3 years, even though it is making its debut with no advertisers yet on board. If it finds a following, it may later become a paid subscription channel.
Annual meetings of two major U.S. corporations last week overwhelmingly voted down shareholder proposals to explicitly add sexual orientation as a category protected under their equal employment policies. Management at both defense contractor Lockheed Martin and regional telecommunications provider Altel recommended against the policy change while declaring they do not discriminate against gays and lesbians. Lockheed Martin shareholders rejected the proposal by Pennsylvania's Swarthmore College 92% to 5%. Altel shareholders rejected the proposal led by Walden Asset Management 88% to 9%.
But the Connecticut State House of Representatives this week gave nearly 2-to-1 approval to a bill allowing individuals to designate the person they wish to make some health-related decisions in the event of their death or disability. The bill never mentions same-gender couples and is very much weaker than the Vermont-style civil unions gay and lesbian activists had sought, although some opponents rejected it as a first step in that direction. If the Connecticut Senate also approves the measure, the governor has said that he will sign it. A recent poll found that well over 80% of Connecticut residents support the bill's provisions.
A U.S. study has failed to confirm that lesbians face a much higher risk of breast cancer than non-gay women. Almost a decade ago, epidemiologist Suzanne Haynes had noted that lesbians had a higher incidence of several known risk factors, including smoking, drinking, weight, and not having born children, and projected from that lesbians might face as much as 2 or 3 times the breast cancer risk of other women. But now Suzanne Dibble, a professor of nursing at the University of California Institute of Health and Aging, has reported a study of nearly 1,000 California lesbians over 40 that compares their health to their non-gay sisters and friends. The lesbians in the study were, in fact, less likely to have borne children and likely to be heavier, but they drank no more and actually smoked less. Their risk of breast cancer was less than 1% greater than that of their heterosexual counterparts.
An Australian study published in the latest British Journal of Psychiatry found bisexuals are more likely than either gays and lesbians or non-gays to suffer from anxiety, depression, and negativity. The report was part of an ongoing investigation of nearly 5,000 Canberra residents, comparing a group in their early 20s with a group in their early 40s, although less than 3% of participants identified themselves as homosexual or bisexual. The researchers cited bad experiences both as children and as adults, financial problems, and weaker social support systems as contributing to bisexual special risks. They concluded that it is possible that having neither a clear heterosexual or homosexual orientation is an important stressor in addition to the social pressures of having a different sexual orientation to the majority.
That may not be Australian bisexuals' only reason for anxiety. A sizable number of married men were among the more than 100 arrested in a Melbourne train station toilet in a 2-week police sting called Operation Dalliance. Victoria State Police defended this use of plainclothes police in the face of protests of entrapment. The Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby claimed that increasing uniform patrols would have been an effective response to the reports of underage sex workers cited by police. Having heard several complaints of entrapment, gay policing activist Peter Horsley said, "If you're trying to catch pedophiles, you don't use 35-year-old undercover police officers." A large majority of the men arrested in the sting are expected to go into diversion programs rather than to trial.
And finally, in Taiwan this week, media revelation of a discriminatory policy led quickly to protest and a promise of reform. First came a Taiwanese news report that the Ministry of Defense had formalized a long-standing policy of barring gays from the National Military Police, even though Taiwan does not ban them from any branch of its armed forces. Military police candidates are specifically selected for height and good looks, The 10,000-member force serves primarily as security guards for the president and government facilities. The Military Police Command issued a brief statement confirming the news report, justifying rejection of those with what it labels a sexual orientation impairment with security concerns and the convenience of managing and meeting the needs of the job. Yet even that brief statement said that the force respects human rights and might drop the heterosexual requirement if necessary. Gay and lesbian activists lost no time in making clear reform was indeed necessary, delivering their statement of protest to the Ministry of Defense the next day. And in the face of the flurry of media attention, Military Police Command immediately promised to revise its policy. A spokesperson said the anti-gay rule stemmed from the days when homosexuality was considered a mental illness and called it not quite appropriate to current standards. Defense Minister Tang Yao Ming promised lawmakers the discriminatory rule would be dropped, but said that gays should only live in larger barracks than the usual 6-bed military police units. That earned a jeer from legislator Chao Liang Yen, who said, "If one homosexual was in a 6-man room, could he go and violate the other 5? I doubt that he could achieve such an objective."
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 4th, 2002. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
Once upon a time, Australian lesbians were singing the Lavender Blues. It's a tune you'll enjoy hearing later in the program. Trembling Before God is a lyrical film about the faith, sexuality, and religious life of Hasidic and Orthodox gays and lesbians. The acclaimed documentary began its run at Sundance last year and has since won awards at film festivals from Chicago to Berlin. After playing for months in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York, Trembling Before God is finally finding its way onto theater screens across North America, as well as in Great Britain, Israel, Germany, France, and Switzerland. This Way Out's Steve Pride found out more about this small movie that's making big waves from filmmaker activist Sandy Simcha Dubowski and two of the people featured in his documentary.
If the Orthodox and Hasidic traditions strictly follow Jewish law, and Jewish law explicitly prohibits homosexuality, how can it be otherwise? Rather than suppress sexuality or abandon religion, can one reconcile their own essential nature with a community that often holds them in contempt? Or is it possible to change centuries of religious dogma? These are just a few of the many questions raised in the documentary Trembling Before God.
I'm Sandy Simcha Dubowski, the director of Trembling Before God.
David Silverstein in the film.
Michelle Miller, also in the film.
The film took 6 years to make. I spent 5 years crisscrossing the globe just to find anyone who was willing to come forward. I really feel like people like David and Michelle are pioneers. They're the only ones who are really willing to go public, and I met hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. And a lot of people appear in the film in silhouette. I don't think it was so easy. I mean, even David pulled out of the film 5 or 6 times. You know, certainly Michelle was the only one I met worldwide from a Hasidic family who was willing to come forward. And, you know, I think for everyone, it was a real struggle to come forward. Rabbi Steve Greenberg, when I met him, he was a closeted Orthodox rabbi. He said, "I can't do this film. I can't be open." And, you know, I said, "Well, let's just do an interview for practice." And then a year later, in 1999, he decided to come out as the first openly gay Orthodox rabbi. Of course, 10 days later, I asked him if I could bring someone for Shabbat. That person's now his partner of 3 years. So I play filmmaker / matchmaker.
Trembling Before God is filled with personal narratives of struggle and denial.
I was raised in a Hasidic home of Polish descent. The sect is called Babov, and they are very, very strict people, a very insular community. I was not exposed to any outside media or any influence from the outside world while I was being raised, and grew up with very little exposure to the outside world and therefore very little knowledge of who I was and no validation at all to sort of confirm the feelings I had about myself. Women really have a harder time coming from a very Orthodox background because by the time they realize who they really are, they're pinned down with about 6 or 7 kids at home.
I grew up Orthodox. I didn't grow up Hasidic. We kept the kosher and the holidays and synagogue and not driving on the Sabbath and very traditional. And I went to Jewish day schools through 12th grade and then to a yeshiva School of Higher Learning in Israel, where we learned Talmud all day. When I was 19, then I went to secular university, University of Illinois, and I realized within a week that I was gay. I mean, I was 19 years not knowing because I had no exposure. Then I realized, that's what's going on here.
But what does it mean in Judaism to be Orthodox or Hasidic?
There are different denominations of Judaism. Some are more strict and others are more lenient. The more lenient ones are the more recent ones that came along with the Enlightenment, which are Reform and Reconstructionist Judaism. The ones that are based on the real old traditions and still carry over into this day and age with those traditions are the Orthodox, modern Orthodox, and the Hasidic Jews.
The conservative Reform are more lenient with the letter of the law. And as times have changed, they have changed certain laws. Whereas over thousands of years, Orthodox and Hasidic do not change the letter of the law. And that's why it's so much more difficult for the Orthodox to deal with this issue of homosexuality.
Do people go to conservative or Reform or Reconstructionist movement because there's more acceptance there? I tried that, but it wasn't the same Judaism I grew up with.
There is no prohibition of homosexuality in the Torah. There's no such thing as a homosexual identity in the Torah. There's no such prohibition of same-sex loving, because that would apply equally then to men and women. There's no mention really of lesbianism in the Torah, only it's a rabbinic prohibition. So what the Torah is really pointing to is a prohibition of penetration between two men, of anal sex. I mean, that's how most rabbis I interviewed refer it to. But that then opens the question, why is the Bible so concerned about penetration between men? And what does it mean when a man lies with another man in the way of lying with a woman? It's as if the Torah is saying that man who becomes like a woman by being penetrated is the problem.
This law is Mishkav Zachar in Hebrew, meaning a man lying in bed with another man as he would with a woman. It's not written outright in the Torah that women are not allowed to be gay or women are not allowed to have relationships. And what I find most amusing is that the rabbis who argued these rules and these issues in one area gave the earliest reference of artificial insemination that I could ever find, where a rabbi suggested that the only reason that two women would be rubbing against each other would be for one woman to pass the sperm of her husband to the other woman so that she can conceive.
It's symptomatic that when Torah and the rabbis speak about lesbianism, it often is more about whether a woman is straying from her husband. It's more the problem of a woman not being under the control of her husband. That's where the lesbian issues come about. But with men, it's always about the act of penetration.
But at the same time, they still treat women who are lesbians just as evilly and wickedly as they treat men who are gay.
If the Orthodox community actually behaved according to the Torah, then they would regard male homosexuality as different than female homosexuality, and instead they lump them all together and say it's an abomination.
In Trembling Before God, Sandy Dabowski interviewed an assortment of psychologists, rabbis, and Orthodox gays. There are heart-wrenching stories of suicides, electroshock therapy, and miserable couples still married despite one spouse's homosexuality. But what is the answer?
For me, the film isn't going to give any easy answers. It's provoking a lot of questions. And the most important thing is the dialogue that results. Because for too long, this has been a very easily answered question. Getting married and lying, or leaving the community? That's the answer. Case closed. But for the first time, you're hearing the human testimony of people who live with that verse every day. These are people who've bent every which way to try to follow the straight and narrow path and couldn't. So how can we make Torah a blueprint and a vision for humanity and not just an exclusive club that can determine who's in and who's out? That maybe Torah can really be a light for Jews and for all people.
Wherever it plays, Trembling Before God transcends the screen to become a community event. Seemingly everywhere at once, Sandy Dabowski attends most opening nights to field questions. Having already moderated Mormon-Jewish gay dialogues in Utah and taken his film to rabbinic retreats in Israel, the untiring Dabowski will next tour the film to Christian theological seminaries in the American South. For more information on Trembling Before God or to find out when it will reach the multiplex in your town, point your internet browser to www.tremblingbeforegod.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
This is Michael Nava, the author of the Henry Rios Mysteries. But it's no mystery to what we're listening to. It's This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Alex Dobkin was the first open lesbian in the United States to release a record album, 1974's Lavender Jane Loves Women. But in the land down under, another strain of queer music was evolving. This Way Out's audiophile co-host J.D. Doyle, who also produces Queer Music Heritage on KPFT in Houston, Texas, brings us the first of a two-part exploration of the early out music of Australia.
Wake up, sister, and realize one thing. It's your life to live, and it's your song to sing.
My guest is Nikki Mortier, and she is part of the history of gay and lesbian music in Australia, because she was a member of the group that issued the first album there by a lesbian band in 1978. The name of the album is Wake Up Sister, and the group is called Lavender Blues. I asked Nikki to tell us about the group.
Well, Lavender Blues was a trio of women, a lesbian trio, set up in about 1977, 78. It was comprised of myself, Darrell Pinch, who was then my partner, and Carol Deegan. Darrell was a songwriter, a very good songwriter, really. And one night we were sitting around, as one did in the 70s. In those days, it was a flagon of wine. And we had that in the middle of the floor, and there were a group of us slowly sinking into the west with the flagon and singing songs. And we realised that we were forgetting the words of Darrell's songs. So someone in the room said, would we make a tape recording of it for them before we forgot the words? And someone else said, oh yeah, I want a copy of that too. And then someone said, I want a copy of that too. And I said, sort of half jokingly, oh look, there's so many people want a copy, we should just make a record. And everyone laughed and fell about and said, yeah, let's do that. And we all sort of fell into hysterics about making a record and how silly the idea was. The next morning I woke up and my immediate thought was, well, hang on, why don't we make a record? What's stop us? And so we did. We produced the record and then promoted it and became very popular in Sydney and Melbourne, the sort of east coast of Australia. Women were starved in those days for anything because, as far as I know, we were the first Australian lesbian group to put out an album. So we were sort of the flavour of the month in the lesbian community for a couple of years.
How did you name the group?
Well, Darrell had written a song, which is on the record, called Lavender Blues Mean What They Say, I'll Never Again Be Any Man's Lay. And so from that song, we took the name Lavender Blues.
Let's hear a little more of Lavender Blues.
If you're a lesbian freak with a feminist streak, if you're madly fixated in a role that's outdated, you violate all the cultural taboos. Come on and join in on the Lavender Blues, yeah. Come on and sing the Lavender Blues. Lavender Blues mean what they say, I'll never again be any man's slave. Lavender Blues, just come and see, it's a lavender world when your feelings run free.
One of the songs on the album is called Lesbian Nation, and I thought the lyrics to it were kind of interesting because it was like saying, okay women, we've helped your women's causes, now it's your turn to help with lesbian causes.
Absolutely. By the mid to late 70s, the women's movement had arrived. Lesbians were disproportionately represented and were very much drivers of a lot of the political action. And there were a lot of feminists who took the view that they didn't want to be outwardly supportive of lesbians and therefore maybe labelled themselves as lesbians.
I think that was true here too.
Yes, because they felt that would discredit the feminist cause. That caused a lot of bitterness. So that particular song was sort of, I guess, an expression of our frustration, of to some extent a feeling of being used and abused.
Don't want to knock sisters who are straight, but when it comes to choosing a mate, I fought for your rights and that's so fine. What have you done to fight for mine? Where do we go to after? liberation. Is this a really our salvation? Building a road to a lesbian nation, or leading back to isolation?
That was a little of the song, Lesbian Nation. I wonder if you can compare the women's music movement in the United States to that in Australia. Like in the 70s here, there were all the Olivia artists like Holly Near, Mae Christian, and so forth. Was there anything comparable in Australia?
Not really, to my knowledge. In fact, those artists were sort of the dominant music for Australia. And that's true in our mainstream culture as well, that American music has tended to dominate our musical culture. And certainly Mae Christian and Tret Fury and Chris Williamson, they were sort of the big popular artists. And in some ways still are.
Judy Small has been your country's most popular lesbian folk singer for many years. Does she go back that far?
Well, Judy does go back that far. I mean, I'm a great Judy Small fan. She's a wonderful performer. She actually performed one night when she was known in the folk circuit, but not much else. And we actually employed her, Lavender Blues employed her to sing at a concert that we were putting on, where, if you like, we were the headline act when we were at our peak. And in some ways, I think that concert became a real launching pad for her career.
Looking back 20-plus years after doing that album, do you have any comments?
We did it with a number of things in mind. I mean, one of them was because we wanted to preserve the music, and I think that's incredibly important, that we preserve our culture and our music, and I think we're not very good at that. We still haven't learnt to value our heritage, and so I'm very pleased we put it down on a record. Given the circumstances, I think we didn't do too bad a job.
Next week in part two of this feature on Aussie Music, we'll hear Judy Small's version of her association with the Lavender Blues, and let her bring us up to date with her latest and very out-of-the-closet album, Let the Rainbow Shine.
I've been recording songs about gay and lesbian issues for a very long time, and I had had over the years just enormous support, particularly from the lesbian community. And so I sort of wanted to give something back, I guess.
For This Way Out, I'm J.D. Doyle.
If you're immature or just not sure, if you're feeling frustrated and deactivated, move on and take up the cues to join in on the Lavender Blues, yeah. Come on and sing the Lavender Blues.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, John Beaupre, Graham Underhill, Brian Nunes, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambidge, Rex Walkner, Steve Fried, and J.D. Doyle contributed program material. The Brandeis Bard and Klezmer Ensemble performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's an easy link to the show from our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To learn how you can help in This Way Out's critical struggle to stay on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on Dade City Community Radio, Dade City, Florida, KXCI Tucson, Arizona, to BOB Taree, New South Wales, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.